You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we hear about a major cultural shift that is occurring with very little attention. Think back to 1950 or 1960 and reflect on the expected and idealized role of an American woman. We have to say it would be the stay-at-home mother. Now fast forward 50 years. Today, women are the primary wage earner in about 40% of American households. And if trends continue, there'll be a majority of breadwinners in about 20 years. Well, this change is having profound social implications in our gender roles, relationships, and social dynamics. My guest today calls it the big flip. Liza Mundy is a staff writer at the Washington Post. She's author of the previous book, Michelle, a biography on First Lady Michelle Obama. Her latest book is titled The Richer Sex, How the New Majority of Female Breadwinners is Transforming Sex, Love, and Family. It's published by Simon & Schuster. She uses fresh statistics as well as lots of interviews with men and women who are already living this new reality and finding success that make both genders happier. She joins us today by phone here on Studio Tulsa. Liza Mundy, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Your book, The Richer Sex, talks about how this major societal change we have in which women are on the path, at least in the United States, to become the majority breadwinner in households. It's not happened yet, but it's getting closer every day.
Right. Well, if you look at the trends, and this is actually the case in a number of other countries as well, if you look at the trends, you see that almost 40% of working wives out-earn their husbands currently, which is a statistic that's usually, you know, higher than most people would guess. And the government, interestingly enough, tracks this. And if you look back at the late 80s when they started tracking it, there's been a steady rise. So if the rise were simply to continue at the same pace, then by about 2030, a majority of working wives would out-earn their husbands. And at the same time, we have this growing pool of single moms raising kids alone. And so it does seem entirely possible that around that same time, 2030, we could have more mothers supporting households than fathers.
And so your book starts looking at the social implications, and they're really vast, because when you have to think back 100 years ago, women in this country didn't have the vote, and probably in a majority of states, if not all, or nearly all, they couldn't own property. They had really very little rights as far as what we would consider just essential human rights.
The history of it is fascinating, and I think, you know, many of us don't realize, just as you say, that not all that long ago, women, when they married, lost the right to their wages and lost the right to own property and were really, you know, profoundly disempowered in marriage. And society believed that this was important. It was widely believed that if a wife had earnings or property of her own, you know, she would be less likely to be a suitable wife. She would become unpleasant. As one letter writer to a magazine in the early 20th century wrote, she becomes more critical and less lenient of her husband's faults and failings. In the late 19th century, when in England they were considering giving property rights to married women, the London Times just wrote a thundering editorial about how this would destroy marriage as society knew it. And, of course, marriage was the underpinning of society in general, and they too believed that they wrote, if a wife had had her own earnings and the right to keep them, what is to prevent her from going where she likes and doing what she pleases? And this was considered undesirable. And they wrote about how marriage was consisted of authority on one side and subordination on the other. So it really is a very new thing for women to have even, you know, economic rights in marriage, much less, you know, higher earnings than their partner.
Now, certainly the subordination was a part of all classes, but really the idea of working and making money was very much a class issue. Lower classes, both people in the relationship, men and women, would have to work just to survive. But in middle and upper classes, there was a great exclusion towards women working for at least the first 20, 30 years of the past century, at least till about
Sure.
the 20s or
Now,
30s.
Yes, and I would say that it was generally considered stigmatizing for a husband if his wife had to work. And so even among poorer classes of society, the woman might, well, she probably wasn't going to be making a wage that was the equivalent of a male wage. And she might work quietly in the home. A lot of women took in work, like took in sewing work and did it in the home, in part because workplaces weren't necessarily open to women, and in part because it was stigmatizing. To be a husband and for your wife not to have to work was considered was a symbol that you were an adequate provider. And that's one reason during the Depression, when men were thrown out of work, and in the sort of rare cases where women were able to support their households, maybe by taking in boarders, this was incredibly, you know, it was very difficult for the men in terms of their identity as breadwinners. And the women were stigmatized also. I mean, sociologists have shown that wives and mothers who supported their households weren't necessarily thanked by their own families. It was just considered such a radical upending of the way that things were supposed to be.
For about the first half of the century, women who worked in specific fields, nursing, teaching, clerical, especially in the post-war
right.
era. And, of course, those divides began erasing in the 70s and 80s, and we've seen increasingly two trends. One is those fields are seeing fewer women go into those fields, and two, and education is the big difference. Women are dominating higher education today.
That's right. About 57% of college and university students these days are women, and that's projected to rise to 60%. And women are also taking the majority of doctorates, master's, and associate's degrees. So one thing that happened in the 70s and 80s is that many campuses opened up to women that had been all male before that. And also, as workplace incentives began to change, as women began to understand that there was more opportunity for them in the workplace, they had a new incentive to go to college and the sense that there would be an economic payoff to it. It's also been pretty conclusively proven by economists that when the birth control pill came on the landscape and women knew that they would have reliable contraception and could plan their families and not have a career be interrupted by unintended pregnancies, that they also began to increase their college going, that this was another major incentive for women to improve their educational credentials and their professional training. And just as you say, many more women now are training for business than are training for teaching. There was a diversion away from certain traditional professions into new fields. And what's so interesting is that there are a number of fields that have flipped completely. The field of psychology has gone from being all male to being all female. Veterinary medicine classrooms are now virtually all female. Many specialties in medicine, doctors under 45 are majority female. So it's really interesting to see how women have targeted certain professions, often professions that have more regular, predictable hours and will enable them to continue working after they have children, and then women have gone into those fields.
Now, I found it interesting because you sort of allude to the fact that maybe men are avoiding those professions as they start flipping.
Yeah, this is a fascinating phenomenon. Some academics have looked at what they call gender pollution, which is the idea that if too many women are in a field, like if too many women are in, say, veterinary medicine classrooms, men simply won't go into that field, which is really fascinating. I mean, it'll be interesting to see the test of this as our economy is changing, and for example, healthcare is an expanding field, even as manufacturing is contracting. You know, will men become nurses in any greater quantity? Nursing is a good job. It's the number one job in terms of job growth, according to government projections. So, you know, what would it take for a tipping point for men to really go into a pretty well-paying women's field?
Hmm. Interesting. You made a point earlier so that women started going to college when they could see the payoff. And conversely, some men are actually starting to see colleges not having that payoff, and that's one of the reasons they're not going to college.
You know, the reasons why men aren't going to college are really fascinating, and I think we need to look more at this. I mean, Some people argue, I think persuasively, that that girls in some ways are better suited to school. They make better grades. They like school better. They're more likely to go on to college. Boys mature a little bit later, so the college application process is not necessarily something that they're ready for. But one of the things I noted in my interviews in the book, and I interviewed lots and lots of couples and individuals and collected a lot of stories, is that boys are often, particularly in the working class, dissuaded from going to college by their families. Because they think of themselves as providers, they're pressured to get out into the workforce right after high school. And of course, there used to be reasonably high-paying jobs for a male high school graduate, but those are the jobs that are going away. And I think parents and families really need to change their messages to these young men. Studies show that parents in general are more likely to pay for their daughter's college education than for their sons. And that this, too, is a flip. I mean, this is a reversal. Parents used to invest much more in their sons' education than their daughters, and now the opposite is true.
How interesting. And you think it's this idea that this whole social role of being the provider is still deeply ingrained, and I need to go out and make money.
Right.
I can postpone college.
Right.
And sometimes if I postpone college, I never go.
Exactly.
Is it that sort of thinking that's going on?
Exactly. I mean, ironically enough, I think in many cases the provider mentality is working against young men. For example, I spent a fair amount of time in Deep South Texas in a Latino community there, and Hispanic girls are out-achieving young men academically at an even greater rate than sort of the national average. And what I found talking to men and women is the young women realize that they hear this from their families. You know, you need to go to college. You've got to be able to support yourself. You might be a single mom someday. You might be divorced someday. You can't rely on a man. You've got to be able to support yourself. Whereas the guys really feel right after high school that they have to get out and start working and earning. They might be supporting their parents. They might be supporting extended families. And their parents aren't making it feasible for them to go to college. I interviewed one lovely young couple where the wife went to college. She's got a master's. She's working on her doctorate. She married her high school sweetheart. He had to leave college after the first year or two in order to get a job. And in order to get a job, he had to get a truck, and he had to make payments on his truck, and he didn't qualify for financial aid because he had a job. So he dropped out, and it wasn't until a number of years later, with the encouragement and example of his wife, that he finally went back to college, and thanks to her encouragement, got his degree. But he had a much tougher time of it, in part because he really felt pressured to earn. So ironically enough, the young women don't think of themselves as providers. They're staying in school, and they're emerging better equipped to provide.
So talk about the difficulty in adjusting to these new roles, because I would think women are having some issues in adjusting the fact that in their relationships, they may be the breadwinner. Men certainly having probably issues with not being the breadwinner. And you found examples of where it's working well and areas where it's just not working at all.
Yeah, all of the above. I mean, I argue that ultimately it's a lot better for women to be economically empowered in marriage than not. I mean, we know what the not was like. And I also believe that as this becomes more acceptable, as men become supportive partners and in some cases secondary earners, or stay-at-home dads, that this is going to really help women rise in the workplace, to have someone who is really supporting their career. And I interviewed a number of women who had achieved very high positions in their workplaces thanks to the support and the household work of their husbands. So I think that ultimately it will provide men with a lot more opportunities in life not to have that pressure to be the sole breadwinner, and it will provide women with support they need to really break through the glass ceiling. But that said, just as you say, I interviewed any number of women whose partners became jealous or retaliatory, and I interviewed women who were struggling with new questions. I mean, who were coming to understand what it feels like to be the breadwinner. I interviewed one young woman in Northern California who works in the aerospace industry. Her husband had gotten a master's but emerged from graduate school into a recession environment and couldn't find a job. And she was really feeling the pressure of supporting a household. They had to get married earlier than they expected because she had to put him on her health insurance. And she was working as hard as she could in her own workplace to keep her job. ironically, because she was working harder than ever, she was getting better performance evaluations, and she was really feeling better and better about herself as a worker. Her husband was doing all the housework at home, all the cooking and all the cleaning, and he said, I need to do this to show that I'm still valuable. But what was interesting was that once he found a job but still wasn't making as much as she was, she found herself wrestling with the question of, well, do I really need to pitch in and do, you know, 50% of the housework? I mean, we've always argued that men need to do more housework, that just being the breadwinner doesn't buy you out of domestic duties. But she was really struggling with this, I am earning more, I am the one traveling a lot, do I really have to cook dinner, you know, 3.5 nights a week, or could I rest a little bit when I get home? So it was reopening some of the questions that we thought that we had resolved, because she had always thought of herself as very feminist, very progressive, but she was starting to feel as though she deserved some kind of breadwinning entitlement.
I think that was one of the most interesting things that you found in the course of your research, is the fact that these roles are just reversing so easily. Another woman, several women talked about the feeling of the fear of being the breadwinner as being somewhat emasculating to their partner. And yet there are women who were holding the purse strings very tightly, as men did in the 1950s, where the men were having to come to the woman and say, can I have some money for such
and such? Right, right. Yes, I was surprised by the number of women who said, you know, I worry that my husband feels emasculated having to ask me for money. Because I thought, well, why should he have to ask you for money? I mean, why don't you have a joint checking account and two ATM cards? And another interesting thing that studies show is that actually traditional male breadwinners were more likely to share their earnings, to think of themselves as providers, to hand over their pay packets or most of their pay packets, and, you know, and entrust their wife with the deployment of it. And female women are more likely to hang on to their earnings and to feel somewhat territorial about them. For example, this woman I talked about, when her husband took their cat to the vet and authorized an expensive procedure, she admitted, she said, you know, I felt like he just spent a bunch of my money without asking me. So she was, I think because women, our earnings have traditionally been supplementary. We thought of them as our pin money, our money to spend as we want, that women are still kind of struggling with the idea that it's, you know, it's not my money, it's our money.
My guest today is Liza Mundy, a staff writer at The Washington Post, author of Michelle, a biography on First Lady Michelle Obama. Her latest book is very fascinating. It's looking at these changing gender roles and the fact that more women are becoming the breadwinners in relationship. The Richer Sex is the name of the book, How the New Majority of Female Breadwinners is Transforming Sex, Love, and Family. It's published by Simon & Schuster. She's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, let's talk about relationships. This has to be having a major effect on relationships. And I think you talk to young college age women where, you know, it's like, you know, there's definitely a list of things, you know, that, you know, not going to cut it. The guy's got to go to college, and they're having trouble finding as many partners because, you know, in certain universities, it's like 2-1.
Right. Alaska is already there. Yeah, 150 to 100. But what's so interesting and what's really unprecedented for this generation of young women is because women do outnumber men in terms of college degrees among under 30s, women now face a diminished pool of men with their similar credentials. And traditionally, for the past several decades, what most Americans have expected if they get married is to marry somebody with their same level of education. Women no longer expect to marry up to a man with higher education, like in the 1950s women did, but they expect to match. And so now women are really having to ask themselves, you know, would I marry a guy who didn't go to college? And if so, you know, what would be the criteria that I would be looking for? And I interviewed a number of young women to ask them about this, and they would say, gosh, you know, I was just talking about this with my girlfriends over dinner. I was just talking about this in my college dorm room. It's a live question. And I have to say, a lot of women were skeptical about it. They think of college education as a proxy for drive and ambition and an ability to hold a conversation. And these are all qualities, you know, they talk about needing to marry a man I can admire. And a college degree for them goes along with that. And so that was one thing. But it's also interesting, you know, the economic payoff to women's education is starting to show up. And a really interesting study showed that in most American cities now, Childless single women under 30 make more than their male peers. So in a lot of cities, women on the dating market really do make more than their boyfriends and more than the guys that they're meeting. And I interviewed lots of young women about, they've developed these strategies to sort of minimize their earnings. And sometimes they lie about what they do and don't acknowledge that they're a doctor or a lawyer. And sometimes they do little things, like one young woman carries lots of ones and fives and $10 bills so that she can discreetly pay for things like parking and tips without having it seem like she's actually paying. She doesn't want to flaunt her earnings.
I think there was one story about a woman who buys her theater tickets online, yep, and says, oh, yeah, they had some tickets at the office, as your free,
right,
tickets. And it was sort of, you know, just very interesting subterfuges, I think.
Right, finding ways to soften the blow. And you know, I think some people think that that might sound condescending, but I think, you know, really women are trying to figure out how to present themselves as feminine, as, you know, and they don't want to seem like they don't need it, like they're not needy in any way. And trying to find a way so that they will still appear like they need something. Well, and I think, you know, stigma is not to be kind of discounted either. The signals that you get from society or sometimes from your own family about, you know, the kind of guy you should be going out with or the kind of guy you should marry.
Well, I don't think we should discount the fact, the whole flip-flop of these social roles in 60 years. Think of the ideal American woman in 1950. You know, this was a stay-at-home mom who was hip to the latest, you know, I mean, it was,
right,
but definitely for the most part at home or,
right,
a career woman.
Right.
And not involved with a family. And these things are, this has really flipped quickly. And what's interesting, another issue is, you know, how men and women deal with a family. You're seeing these roles where the woman is the high powered wage earner, out of town a lot, coming home late. These roles that we assume about men and women are flipping too, where the man is totally a stay-home dad, totally in tune with what the children are doing, know the PTA parents, know the teachers at school. The woman who's the bread earner is the one who doesn't.
Right, exactly. And some women can find that a little unsettling. I interviewed one woman whose husband had lost his job in the recession, and she had gone back to work full-time. And she was delighted that he had so much time with their sons for the first time. But she had to accept the fact that when their sons brought home their artwork at the end of the year, she had been written out of the picture, literally. And her husband was the one who was in all the pictures. And that's a small example, but it was a profound change for her. But it was really interesting for me. I interviewed a family in Michigan of six adult children who had been raised by a stay-at-home mom and an adult breadwinner dad who worked for Ford. And in adulthood, five of the six siblings were in female earner households. Three of them are heterosexual marriage, where the wife is the primary earner, really successful women, all of them mothers, with these really supportive stay-at-home husbands or secondary earner husbands who ran such a great household. I mean, all these guys really enjoy, you know, raising children now is, you know, it's driving them, it's coaching them, it's taking them to athletic activities. One of the husbands had turned his children into, you know, crack golfers. And he also, I mean, he's so funny. He does all the cooking and cleaning, and one day when the neighbors came over for a card game, he was holding a dust cloth, I think, and the neighbors started calling him Coco. And he really embraced that nickname. I mean, he thought that it was very funny. And he's just a great guy who is very attentive to the needs of his children. And he told this wonderful anecdote about how his wife came home from work one day, and if she's had a bad day, she'll text him the word red, and he'll have a glass of red wine waiting for her. But one day when she had such a bad day, and she sort of staggered in and was talking to him about her day, and he said, well, did you see what was outside before you came in? And she went back outside, and he had made her a margarita and left it on the doorstep for her with a sign that said, drink before entering. And, you know, in answer to the Freudian question of what women want, I think many of us would agree that a margarita, yeah, on the doorstep at the end of a hard day is really one good answer.
Well, my guest today is Liza Mundy. Her new book is titled The Richer Sex, How the New Majority of Female Breadwinners is Transforming Sex, Love, and Family, published by Simon & Schuster. Well, for all these great couples, you're also seeing women who just say, I don't think I need a man in my life, too.
Yep. And particularly, I think, you know, when women who, I mean, we know this, working class America, even now middle class America, if women are the ones with the education and the jobs, men are facing these diminished prospects because our economy is changing and high paying industrial jobs for high school graduates are going away. Women are saying, you know what, I can support myself, I can support a child, but I don't want to support a dependent male. And so I think this is where we really do need to figure out how to, you know, help these guys get either college degrees or the kind of training that they need to adjust to our changing economy.
I want to talk about one last area in our last couple of minutes, and that has to do with certain religious communities here in the United States, as well as probably certain ethnic cultures where you're looking at generations and generations of males as patriarchs. How are they adjusting?
Yeah, this is hard. I mean, there are a number of religions where it's explicitly taught, you know, that the husband should be the household leader and the household provider, and that the wife should be submissive. I mean, there's a lot of theological talk about certain biblical passages instructing submission, and this is very difficult for people who are faithful adherents to, in the case where the wife is more educated and maybe the one who should be in the workplace. And one way in which some couples are dealing with this is that the pastor will say, well, it's okay for you to work because your husband is directing you to work. Your husband is directing you to be the earner. And so really you are still submitting to your husband's household leadership. So that's sort of a loophole that I found some people were falling back on.
But you did interview, for example, I know there was a Mormon wife
yep.
who basically
mm-hmm.
was telling her daughter, you know, don't listen to everything you hear from the pulpit.
This
gets a little more subversive towards this whole culture. Yeah.
Right. Well, she, you know, she's a believer and she teaches Sunday school, but she believes that the directive that the woman should, you know, take care of the house and that the husband should be the household provider, she doesn't believe that's an essential part of church teaching. She thinks it's been sort of tacked on. So, she does subvert that message.
Well, give us a sense of how quickly this is changing. You said by 2030, if the trends continue as they are, that a majority of women will be the breadwinner in the family relationships. Other countries going through this as well?
Absolutely. I mean, what people don't realize is that women are a majority of college and university students in most countries in the world now. And, of course, some countries don't have a lot of their population going to college, but among those who do, it's often predominantly female, even in developing countries. And so there are these fascinating, I have a chapter on Asia, you know, which is a very traditional culture, and yet Japanese women, for example, and South Korean women are becoming the most educated women, human beings in the world. And so there's this massive repercussions in the marriage market. And one of the things that I saw is the rise of commercialized marriage agencies where, for one thing, they're trying to teach men how to talk to women because, you know, being a provider is no longer going to get them a wife because they're often not in a position now to provide. So trying to teach men how to date, how to talk to a woman, how to court somebody, but also bringing in brides from less developed countries for men who would like a more traditional spouse. So there's this commercialized marriage market developing to preserve traditional relationships for men who would prefer them. As one Spanish demographer put it to me, this is happening in Spain and Europe as well, like women marrying progressive Northern European men, men marrying more traditional immigrant Latina women. He said, men want a woman who used to exist, and women want a man who has yet to exist. That, you know, there's just this, we're in this really profound transitional period. Where dating and romance and marriage are still sort of catching up to the reality of women's changing achievement.
The name of the book is The Richer Sex. Liza Mundy, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Liza Mundy is a staff writer at The Washington Post and author of The Richer Sex, How the New Majority of Female Breadwinners is Transforming Sex, Love, and Family. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.